Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm Lauren Meltzer, your host. Tonight's topic is Between the Lines, Redistricting California. In November, Californians voted a second time to remove elected representatives from the redistricting process or the drawing of electoral boundaries. Voters gave that authority to a newly formed Citizens Redistricting Commission. On Friday, the 14-member commission, composed of 5 Republicans, 5 Democrats, and 4 Independents, approved the maps and lines that will affect state elections for the next 10 years and that will determine how communities are grouped, represented, or silenced in the political process. Tonight, we'll get in between those lines to ask, which groups engaged the redistricting process and to what effect? Do the maps reflect California's shifting political geography and demographics? And can 38 million people really be appeased? Joining me to answer these questions and more are in the studio Commissioner Connie Galambos Malloy of California's Citizens Redistricting Commission. She is also the Senior Director of Programs at Urban Habitat, a regional community action organization that works on policy, advocacy, and movement and leadership building for low-income communities and communities of color. Welcome, Connie.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We also have in studio Carlo De La Cruz, Special Projects Coordinator for the Asian Law Caucus, where he manages the Voting Rights Project and has worked to organize the Asian American and Pacific Islander communities in San Francisco and San Mateo County to engage in the statewide redistricting process since 2009. He is also a member of the Asian American Center for Advancing Justice. Welcome, Carlo.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
And by phone, we have Paul Mitchell. He is head of the Sacramento-based Redistricting Partners, a political redistricting firm working at the state, county, and local level to help governments and outside interest groups navigate the redistricting process. Welcome, Paul.
Glad to be here.
And of course, we'll be taking calls from you. We want to hear your thoughts and your opinions. So give us a call at 415-841-4134 or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And we will start answering calls at about 7:20. So let me start out with Paul. You are the head of the Sacramento-based Redistricting Partners. I'd like you to take us back in history and give us kind of an overview on Props 11, 20, and the Voting Rights Act and why things in Sacramento had to change.
Well, clearly the public has been frustrated by redistricting as it has been done in the past and actually how it's done in a lot of local governments and done a lot of states still. They went into this new experimental version of redistricting reform mirroring after what has been done in San Diego and actually a little bit better process than what's been done in a couple other states. The idea was that by taking redistricting out of the hands of politicians, we would be able to create lines that are fair, that are not driven by partisan advantage or by political deal-making, and then in the end, redistricting would create what it's intended to, which is to bring people closer to their government, equalize districts based on population, and the hope was to go a little bit further. The hope of the voters was that we would have competitive elections as a result of this. Elections that matter was one of the taglines. They would have campaigns would be about kind of a race to the middle. You'd have more moderate elected officials try to reduce the dysfunction here in Sacramento. So there were a lot of these expectations going into it. As the commission found, you know, it's not that easy, and one of the key points you made was the Voting Rights Act. The Voting Rights Act came out, it was from 1965, it was really born out of a lot of the processes that were set up in the Deep South to disenfranchise African Americans. And those laws are applied here in California just as they are in Selma, Alabama. And the way they're applied here in California is really to constrain the commission's ability to draw lines, because they first have to go in and, we might talk about it later, deal with Section 2 and Section 5 districts where they have to reach certain benchmarks for different ethnicities. So the public, I think, really expected the commission to be able to come in, wipe the slate clean and draw competitive districts. But what the commission was really charged with was navigating a much more complex process, dealing with federal law, dealing with communities of interest, dealing with equalizing population in these districts. It just wasn't as easy as the public might have thought.
Now, but you live and breathe this stuff. So when you knew that this was going to take place, what was your confidence in giving the public what they wanted?
Well, I've always had very low confidence in the public getting what they expected, because what I think they expected was not something that would be born out of redistricting, no matter how you set up the process. I think the public oftentimes is sold through campaign TV commercials a message that this is going to solve all of Sacramento's problems, and I don't believe that the commission was given the tools to do that, and I don't think any commission, any redistricting commission anywhere could ever be given the tools to change dysfunction in Sacramento or in D.C. It's one piece of a puzzle, but it's not going to completely radically change government. What I saw when it first was created, when Prop 11 was created, and then afterwards Prop 20, is I talked to folks in Arizona, San Diego, and other states that have done these kind of commissions, and really learned from them how the public could engage, what the process was likely to be like. And this past year, I did a lot of work trying to help groups navigate the redistricting process, and I think that I made a positive contribution to the process while also helping some clients that had specific needs.
And do you think do you think that in a way the public was sold? You know, do you think that there was benefit to this process, from your opinion, even though the public was sold something that maybe would never happen?
Yeah, I think that there was enormous. So I think that the analysis of what we just went through has to be looked at in two ways. One is, just like you said, the process. And this process has been gold standard. There's never been a redistricting in the history of the world that had this many pieces of public input, this many hearings, this many televised. You can go right now and watch a video of 9 hours of commissioners debating where to put a line through the middle of the Central Valley. And you've never had this kind of debate. You've never had it be this transparent. This is something that I think will be seen as a model for other states and localities. I think it's changed redistricting as we know it for decades. Now, that's the process. The second kind of analysis we need to look at is the outcome. Is it going to achieve the things that the political consultants told us it would? And is it, what should the public expect from even the best redistricting process? Should every city in the state expect that they're not going to be divided in half? Should every community of interest expect that they're going to be handed a legislative seat on a gold platter? And the answer to that is no. Redistricting can be a part. This process was incredible, and there's a lot of credit to the commissioners and the staff for doing an amazing amount of work in terms of the process. But the outcomes, we still have districts that look silly. We still have cities being split. We still have communities of interest that maybe weren't divided as artfully as they could have. And as a result, you're still going to have consternation over the outcome. But hopefully people will understand that those are two different questions.
Okay. Well, we'll get back to some of those points in a little bit. Let me go ahead and introduce Connie Galambos. Malloy, welcome, Connie, to the conversation. So you were a part of the process.
Yes. I think we all were in different ways, but yes, I was definitely deep in it.
So first, tell me, how did you get appointed? Who gets appointed to this?
Well, there was a pool of over 30,000 applications that the Bureau of State Audits took the lead on vetting candidates for. And they were looking for a number of different qualities in the applicant pool. One of the key criteria was that applicants had a deep appreciation for California's diverse demography and geography. They were also looking for relevant analytical skills. In my case, I'm an urban planner by profession, and so the ability to deal with data, to deal with maps, the ability to facilitate community processes, I think those all played into my personal application. And they were also looking for the ability to be impartial. So, of course, there are Democrats, Republicans, and dependents on the commission. But across the board, we all had to be able to demonstrate that we had been able to work with people who weren't like us before and come to a positive outcome on those projects. So it was a many-layered process lasting months and months and months. They vetted the 30,000-plus candidates down to a final pool, and those 14 of us got selected.
And did people, do you think that the people that were selected or as a group, when you kind of looked around the room, did you think, uh-oh, or were you, did you feel like they'd done a good job at coming, you know, selecting people that really met the criteria and could work together?
I think that the process really speaks for itself. We spent quite a bit of time together as a commission, both in deliberations, in community input hearings, but also just traveling up and down the state together, having dinner together, exploring different communities. And I really believe that even in those moments where I disagreed with other commissioners on some specific process point or point about a map, that I know that each of my colleagues was really doing what they thought to be in the best interests of their role as a constitutional officer.
And do you think that, were you aware of the fact that the process was transparent? I mean, did that impact how you went to, you approach things or your conduct?
Well, every word we've said as we've been in open session has truly been an open session. It exists on video. It exists in transcripts. You know, contrary to previous rounds of redistricting where you might have, you know, two or three hearings that would happen across the state, we had 34 input hearings. We divided the region up, the state up into regions, and we went out into the local communities both before we ever drew any maps and then after we drew maps to be able to solicit feedback from the public. In the 34 input hearings, we had almost 3,000 individuals that came before us to give testimony. And we also received tens of thousands of public comments that came in by email and came in by snail mail. Some of my favorite submissions were literally hand-drawn maps, you know, with colored pencils, little notes in the margins. And so you really got a feel from a diverse cross-section of California of how they interpreted their communities and what boundaries they thought would make the most sense for them.
So tell us how, I mean, how close or far did you think that the current boundary or the, you know, boundaries before currently were off? I mean, how, were they really off? Or when you really sat and evaluated, did you think, you know, there's some of these really make sense?
I think there are aspects of both. Even though competitiveness was not formally one of our criteria, when you actually look at the state and apply the neutral ranked criteria that the voters approved in the Constitution, it's hard to believe how we wouldn't come out with more competitive districts, because there are some very egregiously gerrymandered districts across the state. And we would sit in hearings and we would hear, you know, dozens of people come and talk about how it had impacted them. Particularly, I remember in the San Joaquin Valley, how people would come and they would say, we have never had a legislator that actually lives here. None of our legislators, not at the assembly level, the Senate level, the congressional level. So they don't understand our needs. They don't travel to our communities. We never see them. That's the type of thing that really made an impact on us as commissioners. And yet there were other places where there were clearly communities of interest that made sense, that were connected, and where we made efforts to keep them connected together in these maps that we currently have now.
And at the end of the day, how did you feel about the final maps?
I feel like, given another 6 months or a year, that they would only continue to get better. We were working on a very tight timeline. As commissioners, we were seated in a commission that had no staff, no infrastructure, no technical consultants, and said, here, go. You've got 7-8 months to pull this off. So I think that the work really reflects the best that we could do given the resources we had at our disposal. But I think what community members have to keep in mind is that our role as commissioners, even my role coming from as a Bay Area person, as an Oakland person, was both to bring my knowledge of the Bay Area to bear on the process, but also that I was there as a representative of the state and to try and balance the often competing communities of interest within the Bay Area, outside of the Bay Area, that are immediately abutting the Bay Area. And so it's a very different role to play than coming there to advocate for your own individual community as the center of the universe versus sure. taking the bird's eye view of what best meets the needs of the entire state's population.
Okay. Well, let me welcome Carlo de la Cruz, Special Projects Coordinator for the Asian Law Caucus. Carlo, you represent one of the communities of interest. So how is the commission, I mean, tell me your impression and the kind of role that you played in the process.
Sure. So the Asian Law Caucus was actually part of a statewide coalition, the Coalition of Asian Pacific Americans for Fair Redistricting, also known as CAPFR. And we worked in 9 different counties across the state, and our mission was to organize Asian and Pacific Islanders to get them more engaged and educated in the redistricting process. And what we initially did was to encourage our own community members to apply for the commission, and that, you know, resulted in greater representation and also greater diversity on the commission. And we think the commission has done a great job in terms of its process, trying to make everything open and transparent and accountable. And for community organizers like myself, what that meant to us is a much more open process that our community members could understand, that our community members could feel like they could be a part of and engage along with the commission. Because when this process happened 10 years ago in 2001, the legislature had hearings, but then you never really heard what happened behind closed doors after those hearings, after community members testified to the legislature about their communities, about their communities of interest. But this time around, we were able to not only have public and open webcasts and meetings, we were able to see the commissioners dialogue with one another, take the communities of interest testimony, take the neighborhoods testimonies into consideration, and we could see the dialogue about how they were trying to balance it. And it makes it a much more easy process for community advocates like the Asian Law Caucus to engage the commission, because we understand where they're coming from in trying to draw a line a certain way. We understood for San Francisco, they had many things to weigh. There are many important communities of interest, including the Asian community, including the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender community, and including low-income immigrants of color. All those communities, including, you know, however you would define yourself as a community of interest, have to be balanced within the redistricting process. And we think that the commission did the best job they could with given the timeline. I remember hearing something like the commission had to draw 177 districts, but less than a year to do it. So when you really think about how many districts they had to draw and balance and the short timeline, we understand the constraints. So given that fact, we think that there are some areas of the state where the maps, they represent our communities well, all communities well, that they do justice to the people in being able to have a voice in the political process and have a vote and to be able to elect the person of their choosing. In other parts of the state, we think that there are still some problems that exist. And, you know, that is due to many reasons. Sometimes it's due to just the geography, that it's very difficult because of the other criteria that the commission has to deal with, like population equality, like compliance with the Voting Rights Act, Section 2 and Section 5. There are certain constraints that don't allow the commission to draw these districts in the, you know, to satisfy everyone. So it's a mixed bag for community advocates like myself. The result has been both good and bad, but we think that the process is definitely a step in the right direction.
Okay. And were there certain areas that you were especially, you mentioned that there were, what areas were those?
So back in 2001, there is a small city in South Bay in Santa Clara County called Berryessa. And this city had about a 51% Asian American population, and they were pretty similar. They were working class, and they considered themselves one united community. Unfortunately, Berryessa was divided along 4 different assembly districts, making it almost impossible for them to have one united voice and to have a really strong presence within the electoral process. Berryessa this time around was kept united, so we thank the commission for that. And so it's fixes like that. It's being able to unite communities that were once divided. Daly City, which is the gateway city to San Francisco County, also has a very large Asian American and Latino population. It was previously divided along 2 assembly lines, 2 assembly districts dividing the city in half. Now it is kept united, and it's even grown further to bring in other similar populations in the surrounding cities, such as Broadmoor and Coma. So those are some of the fixes that we have been able to work towards and being able to protect the voice of not only the Asian community, but many communities of color and many communities that, you know, have a stake in this process.
Okay, that's great. If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the recent redistricting of California. Joining me tonight are Commissioner Connie Galambos-Molloy of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission, Paul Mitchell, head of Redistricting Partners, a political consultancy, and Carlo De La Cruz, Special Projects Coordinator for the Asian Law Caucus. If you'd like to join us, here's the number. 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. I'm curious, for those of you who've been following the news, are you happy with the new districts, or is there something that you feel was done completely unfairly? We'd like to hear from you. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. And I actually use the word unfairly, but I'm sure, Connie, you're thinking everything was fair. I mean, they're as fair as it could be, right, given the circumstances?
Well, you know, the truth is why we were put there as commissioners is often to balance competing or conflicting community of interest testimony. And so there were times where different people have different perceptions of their community and what would result in the best political representation for themselves. And so we as commissioners had to make those tough calls. And so there are some community members who will certainly feel like we made the right choice based on the analysis that we created. And there are other community members who might feel like we missed the boat. So it's definitely a mixed bag. But I think, you know, it might go without saying for people who've been following redistricting, and I think Paul implied it by his initial comments, but one of the greatest changes that has occurred through this redistricting process is that our commission never took into consideration political party affiliation. We never took a look at where incumbents live, where candidates for elected office live. And so in terms of being able to apply neutral criteria and not have it be directly tied to any one individual's political career, this is, I think, Paul said it right. It's really one of a series of government reforms that we'll need to take on in California in order to get Sacramento functioning at a higher level than it has been historically. But I agree, it's certainly a step in the right direction. The other thing I would say to that is I think that this commission will have an exponentially easier time the next time around. There was no precedent for what we did. There was no historical information to say, well, you know, which state agency do we talk to deal with X, Y, or Z? And so just to have that archival information to allow the next commission to get up and up running off the ground, I think is going to, it could potentially cut an easy 3 months off the top of the process.
That's great. Well, Paul, let me bring you back into this conversation and ask you what, you know, how is this going to impact Sacramento, from what we have here?
Well, I think there's going to be short-term impacts and long-term impacts, both in Sacramento and with the delegation to Congress. The short-term impact is that there's kind of panic in the streets about these new lines. A number of members, particularly in the state Senate and Congress, are jostling right now to figure out where they're running, and the whole environment has changed. It used to be that it was kind of sacrilegious to take on an incumbent. In the Bay Area, you saw when Joe Nation took on Lynn Woolsey like 6 years ago, he paid the price for years after that for having taken on an incumbent member of Congress. Now you have members of the legislature announcing against two sitting members of Congress in a couple different districts around the state. You've got, it seems like an hour doesn't go by before I, you know, hear the name of some, you know, old assembly member that's going to be running for Congress. So the number of, this is another number that's really interesting, 67 of the state's 177 elected officials in Congress and the legislature, 67 of them are either drawn out of their district or drawn into the district with somebody else. So there's these short-term effects. This will be the biggest election year that the state has ever seen. You're going to have $10 million congressional campaign probably in Los Angeles if Howard Berman and Brad Sherman face off against each other. Now, the long-term effect is going to be more, up in the air. The long-term effect on Sacramento, the long-term effect of how many of these districts are truly competitive. And I'll push back a little bit on the commissioner on this question of competitiveness. Clearly, the old lines were drawn to maintain incumbents. However, the act of redistricting does in of itself, in the way the commission was given rules, reinforce kind of a stability and reinforce Democratic and Republican districts. And I'll give an example. In a lot of areas of the state, you want to try to separate out the rural communities in, say, Yolo from the urban communities in Sacramento. And in doing so, you are preserving communities of interest, but you're also preserving a Republican district and a Democratic district. So the competitiveness where it did happen, and I'm happy to talk about it, specific examples, but the competitiveness was a unintentional byproduct of the process. The commission wasn't able to look at what the partisanship was of districts. And there might be a little bit more long-term competitiveness, but in the short term, it's going to be like the Wild West.
Well, that's a really interesting point. Connie, what's your response to that?
I think it's definitely true. The definition of communities of interest is around geographically contiguous communities that share common social and economic interests. And it really fell to the local communities to define what that meant to them. In places where we did not have any community feedback that was coming from the place, we as commissioners, those of us who knew something about a given area, we were able to use our own personal or professional backgrounds to make sense of what the communities of interest might be there. But there are certainly, you know, times along the process where we would have organized campaigns around community of interest criteria, and it would fall to our analytical eye to read between the lines and really try and sort out what is usable community of interest data and what is really acting as a shield for some other types of interest that are coming between the lines. So it was a very tricky process, and I think that, you know, there's a reason that those of us who were selected have been in positions before where we're dealing with subjective and competing data, because that's much of what our role was, to try and sort through, you know, the garbage in, garbage out, to what really was the essence of a given place.
Now, with the Asian community, Carlo, would you say that by default, if the Asian community has a voice, that their voice is going to, by default, end up all being a certain, voting for the same candidate or, you know, in the same political party?
I'm glad you asked that, because a lot of times the perception is that because we're fighting to ensure that the voice of the Asian American community is protected in the redistricting process and is represented well, that our natural goal is to get Asian Americans elected officials. That really was not the goal of our coalition, and I don't think it's the goal of many community rights, civil rights organizations like the Mexican American Legal Defense Fund and the African American Redistricting Collaborative. I don't think that's our goal on the offset. It is at times a natural consequence, because we've seen that communities will vote for elected officials and vote for candidates that share their values, share their common interest. And a lot of times that is very easy to understand and relate to when that person comes from your community. So for us, you know, the result of having more Asian American elected officials ultimately in the legislature, in the Senate, in the Congress is a good thing, only because it brings more diversity. It brings more opinions to the table for our communities. We don't necessarily think that it has to be an Asian American candidate to be able to represent these communities well, which is why our focus is really on making sure that the communities are not split up along these lines.
Wait, Paul, I want to come back to you, but first let me say this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Lauren Meltzer. If you're just tuning in, tonight we're discussing the recent redistricting of California. My guests are Commissioner Connie Galambos-Malloy of California Citizens Redistricting Commission, Paul Mitchell, head of Redistricting Partners, a political consultancy, and Carlo de la Cruz, Special Projects Coordinator for the Asian Law Caucus. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134, or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Are you someone that was for the redistricting process? And if so, do you feel like your expectations have been met, or do you feel that you were sold a bag of goods? Give us a call, 415 235 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Paul.
Yeah, I just wanted to play off of something that Carlos said, which is really interesting. And that is that the groups that have been discussed, the Asian, African American, Latino groups that were very active and putting together plans for the commission and trying to fight for their communities of interest, not their politicians, but their communities of interest. They did such a good job sequestering their work from the politicians that all the politicians were calling me. I was getting calls every day from Asian elected officials, Latinos, and African Americans saying, what are they doing? Because they did all their work actually with community organizers, community meetings. There were legislative staff that would try to attend their meetings, and they would send them away. So there's, I'd really like to heap a lot of praise on those groups for depoliticizing their work, even if, you know, there were some, they had some Asian elected officials, and as an example, that were calling me all the time asking why the Asian plan drew them out of their district.
Were there some groups that were more successful than others, Paul?
I think there's a relative scale. Some of the groups you would expect to participate, the like we talked about with the Asians, Latinos, and African Americans, among those, I think all did equally well. It seemed as though there was a little bit slower process for the African American community that didn't, at the outset, propose a statewide plan. But at the end, I think their voice was very well heard. But then I think the more interesting piece is the non-traditional voices in redistricting. Those voices never were heard before, and I'm talking about, as an example, maybe the rural communities. One of my clients and some work that I thought we did was very effective was within the LGBT community. The LGBT community had never been accepted or seen as a community of interest in statewide redistricting anywhere in the country ever. And the commission sought input from the gay community. It obtained from us data showing where the LGBT community existed in places like San Jose and Long Beach, where maybe, unlike West Hollywood, it was less clear, or maybe unlike San Francisco, it was less clear to really see what delineated the LGBT communities. And they were a very active voice, and there were several times where the commissioners would say to the staff, bring up the EQCA layer. We want to see how this shift of lines affects the LGBT community. And as a non-traditional player in redistricting, I think they were really breaking ground and as a result got much better lines for that community.
I have a couple of emails. The first one is from Trudy in Menlo Park, and she wants to know if the public's participation, you know, how it affected the commission.
It affected our work at every level. We used the community of interest testimony as one of the key ingredients in any consideration of how we were drawing lines. We have, you know, for public record, we have a full database of all of the tens of thousands of comments that went into drawing the lines. And it's also, you can break it down by region. And when you go online and you actually see our deliberations, you'll see commissioners referring to handouts that they got at input hearings at various places, referring to emails that had come in real time to the commission. So it really was crucial. And the public being involved every step of the way, both pre-map and post-draft, I think dramatically impacted the process. There were times where we would be drawing a map in a given area in a small town somewhere that, you know, is off the beaten path, and we'd have one community member that might have written in something key about that area, and that piece of testimony would become very crucial to us as we drew those lines.
Well, I actually have another email, and this is from Bob in the South Bay, and he asks, will the commission's work set a precedent for the rest of the country? And I guess I'd be curious to hear from you, Connie, but also maybe from Paul.
Well, we certainly hope that it does. Clearly, we were the pioneers on a great democratic experiment here, and so we have done our best to document the process that we've been through. We are also looking to do and participate in evaluations that are happening of our process to look at not only what did we do well, but what could we have done better. And once we are past this phase of any potential litigation against the maps, we see ourselves as ambassadors nationally to be able to go and talk to other states states and other groups who are considering these types of reforms, express to them how our process went and help them get theirs off the ground.
Okay.
Yeah, and I believe that they have changed redistricting. And, you know, the original redistricting revolution was in the 60s when they said, wait, you know, districts should be equal size. Prior to that, the county of L.A. had one state senator and the county of Tulare had one state senator, and that was inherently unequal. And the idea of one person, one vote was born in the 60s. This is the next revolution in redistricting, and it has two forms. One is the commission idea, the transparency, and the second is public input. Anybody who can play with Google Maps now can actually impact their redistricting. And I think the impact is going to take two forms. It's going to take a vertical and a horizontal. In a vertical manner, it's going down to local government. I'm doing redistricting. I did the redistricting for the city of Elk Grove. I have 14 community college districts I'm doing redistricting for. And each one of these are saying to themselves, hey, how can we make this more transparent? And there's a huge difference there. Nationally, I think on the horizontal scale, other states are also going to be looking at this kind of process. Unfortunately, most states are knee-deep in their process now, and so the effects of this are going to be seen probably in the next 10 years. But I would expect a number of campaigns around the nation to try to create something similar to what we have here in California.
Okay. Carla De La Cruz?
Yeah, I just wanted to add that this time around, we've had partners who are also working in other states, for example, Illinois, and in states like Georgia and Texas on the redistricting. And they're also representing the interest of communities, whether it's the Asian American community, Latino community, or other communities of interest. In those states, we've heard from our colleagues and from our partners that it has been an uphill battle and difficult process, especially when the legislature was controlled by Republicans, because they have no constitutional obligation to let in community advocates in the way that the commission is obligated to have open public hearings across the state. So we're really seeing the difference, even this cycle, how much community members are able to engage in the process versus a legislature that can easily shut out community members and shut out, you know, any kind of advocate, whether it is the private citizen who just cares about their local neighborhood or whether it is an organization trying to protect the civil rights of large communities.
If you're just tuning in, this is City Visions. Tonight we're discussing the recent redistricting of California. Joining me this evening is Commissioner Connie Galambos Malloy of the California Citizens Redistricting Commission, Paul Mitchell, head of Redistricting Partners, a political consultancy, and Carlo De La Cruz, Special Projects Coordinator for the Asian Law Caucus. If you'd like to join us, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or join us by emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Again, the number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or emailing us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Well, we've talked a lot about the public impact in terms of the process. Paul, I guess this is a message, question for you, and Connie, to you too. Did politicians secretly influence the process?
Well, I can speak to that as a commissioner, and I have to say I would really extend a compliment to the legislature and to our congressional delegation for having gone out of their way not to interact with the commission. We as a commission were strictly prohibited, of course, from considering any information about incumbents in our decision-making process. But early on, fairly soon after I had been seated, I realized how strong the firewall was because I was looking for space in the Bay Area to hold hearings. And I thought, well, let me call one of our local congressional representatives, and left a message, and I got a call back several days later saying, I'm sorry, but, you know, our chief of staff can't call you back because you are a commissioner with the Citizens Redistricting Commission. And that reminded me just, you know, how we were all trying to live up to this new process. Now, that said, I know that there were staff of different elected officials that were watching our process online. They were there, you know, taking notes and observing our process. But in terms of actually trying to influence what we as individual commissioners were doing, I have to say that was never in my view that was happening on the commission.
And Paul, from your perspective, did you hear of anything that shouldn't have happened?
Yeah, there's, and I don't want to, the commissioner's right, first off, that the politicians stayed out. There was a lot of discussion among political folks, and I'm deep into the political side because I work in Sacramento and I'm a consultant. There was a lot of discussion of, oh, I know I know Commissioner Dai, or my brother knows Commissioner Yao. And to me, I thought that was useless. Who cares? Because you're not going to be able to have these, you know, one-on-one conversations and lobby for a district. And I didn't see any of that happening. And I didn't even hear rumors of that happening. And I think that they stayed very above board, and there was never even an inference that the commission was doing something to help an elected official. So I think the commission stayed very clean in that regard. The question of whether or not the politicians affected the final product, there was a comment made at the press conference where I believe it was Commissioner Forbes got up and said that he was so proud that the politicians had stayed out of the process. And, you know, about 15 staffers in the back of the room silently chuckled, because there was a lot of attempts to change lines. And there were some, I saw, very blatant moves of, you know, as somebody I knew was political walking up and naming 5 census blocks they want moved in West Covina. And I saw that happening, and I thought to myself, well, they just drew an assembly member back into his district. It was minimal. It probably only happened a few times. But it was a part of the process that you couldn't expect any commissioners or any normal people to be able to discern, that the lady that came up in the Boy Scouts of America's, you know, outfit with the map was actually doing that to help somebody who was a member of Congress. They did spot a couple times in L.A., and they even mentioned at the hearing, that there were organized attempts by a member of Congress to try to get people to a commission hearing. But they were really good at that in trying to weigh that testimony against everything else.
I think the advantage of having commissioners that were selected the way that we were is that even the commissioners who come as having seats in the Democratic seats or the Republican seats, we are all across the board independent thinkers. And so, you know, the upside of that is there is a firewall. They're not, you know, engaged with the party line, so to speak. But of course, that means there are times where they might not catch some of what's going on behind the lines with those, you know, 5 blocks in Covina that you mentioned. And that's why we really did our best to try and analyze all of the data underlying any of the proposals that we were receiving as a commission. Does that mean we caught them 100% of the time across the board? Probably not. But I think that we came much closer to having that blind eye, certainly, than the legislature had done when they did redistricting.
Okay, I want to take a... Actually, let me... Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, what's funny is to try to even compare this to the old redistricting. And, you know, when a lot of these partisans are yelling and screaming about the transparency of the commission, they voted and wanted the process to be completely behind doors. And when people say, well, you know, one or two political people might have influenced this process, it was an entirely political process before. So there really is no fair comparison to the old system. This is a completely different animal, and I think it should be respected for what it did and for what it's going to change in our politics nationally and locally. You know, and I think it's unfair when people start saying, well, you know, we thought it could have been more transparent, or the politicians could have stayed more out of it, because it's so different than what it was 10 years ago.
Okay, let me take a caller. We have Bob from San Leandro. Good evening, Bob. Thank you for joining City Visions. Bob? Oh. Are you there? Oh, Bob, I'm sorry. Could you got cut off a little bit. Could you start again with your question or comment?
Okay, yeah. I would like to talk about what I think is the elephant in the room that no one is addressing, talking about, or mentioning in any way, shape, or form, and that's money. What part did large corporations have in the influence of making these districts, or the influence of influencing the members of the districting committee? I would bet, you know, without even hearing an answer, that there is a very, very large involvement of large corporations and big money in the drawing of these districts, such that it's going to influence the outcome of elections just by the way the districts are drawn.
That's
You people are not mentioning this in any way, shape, or form. And I think it's dishonest to not include an economically impartial drawing of the districts.
Okay, I appreciate your including getting this into the conversation. Connie, can you react to that, please?
Well, you know, I can say as a commission, we had a $3 million budget. It was it came directly to us from the legislature, and that's all the money that we had to work with in terms of our technical consultants, our input hearings, travel costs, our staff, et cetera, et cetera. We did not have, in my knowledge, large influence by corporations. I know that the California Chamber of Commerce had an observer that they resourced to be an observer at our process and at our meetings. But in terms of the corporations themselves having an influence in the process, unless they were organizing behind the scenes with community members to give community of interest testimony, we certainly did not observe corporations to be a major seat at the table. There were times where we were in a given place or region where there were certainly economic considerations that we looked into. For example, if we were in Long Beach and we were looking at the Port of Long Beach and the both environmental and economic impacts to the local community, that was something we took into consideration as we looked at what cities and neighborhoods made sense to be grouped with a place like the Port. But that was really from a broader community perspective than from looking at how to serve corporate interests.
And Paul, do you have anything else to add to that?
I think she's right. There was no big corporate engagement. There was the staff person that the commissioner mentioned that was at almost, I think, every hearing. I think she prides herself on being at more hearings than some of the staff and even some of the commissioners. There was also a statewide plan put forward by a business group, and that statewide plan got, a full discussion and a full airing, and there were sometimes those consultants for a business community would come up and testify, but they were a part of the process, and I don't think it's right to eliminate their role from the process, but they were only a part of the process, and it was relatively small when you compare it to MALDEF or the Asian and African American groups, and it was minuscule when it compared to the 20,000-30,000 pieces of community testimony.
Okay, well, let me change direction here and just ask: Are the maps final, Connie?
So what we did when we adjourned on Friday was that we approved our draft final maps. And when we come back on August 15th, we as a commission will vote one more time, and that will make these maps final. At that point, we take them to the Secretary of State for certification. There are a few more steps to the process. One, the Department of Justice at the federal level has to clear our Section 5 Voting Rights Act counties, which include Merced, Monterey, Yuba, and Kings counties. The public has an opportunity at that point, once the maps are certified, to file any complaints with the California Supreme Court. And we are anticipating that the maps will take place. They'll be already approved in time for next year's June primary, unless we arrive at a situation where either the state Supreme Court or a federal district court issues an order that precludes their use.
Okay. Let me go to a caller. We have Mayor Carlos Romero of East Palo Alto on the line. Welcome to City Visions, Mayor. Thank you.
Hello.
Thank you for calling in to City Visions.
Thank you. Actually, it's a great opportunity to actually have a chance to talk to one of the commissioners. Hi, Connie. We've met before.
Hi, Carlos. Good to hear your voice.
Good to hear that there's some good people on the commission. I certainly support the fact that it's a citizens commission. I know there are going to be some ups and downs. And actually, I'm here to maybe talk about one of the downs potentially. As you may know, and I was reading the transcripts today of some of your deliberations around southern San Mateo County, and I guess that would be northern Santa Clara County, where Palo Alto, eastern Menlo Park, and East Palo Alto intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the we did submit a letter actually asking for a change, but the way the analysis came out, for whatever reason, there was some intent, I'm not sure on whose part, to try to get some affinities between possibly low-income communities of color. So East Menlo Park, Eastern Menlo Park, and East Poplar were affiliated. There's some affinity there. But we were broke. One, Eastern Menlo Park was broken out from Menlo Park, but also this kind of community of interest that we've formed for the last 15 to 20 years between Palo Alto, Menlo Park, and East Palo Alto, in which we have a number of joint powers authorities, as well as some tri-city agreements, has basically been torn asunder by the fact that we're now in two separate congressional districts. And in the past, we've been actually able to get collectively lobby Washington to address some of the issues that we have locally. So I'm not sure, how did the commission go about actually determining the whole issues of communities of interest, and then also the issues of trying to affiliate people of color so that maybe they do have more voting power in a particular district?
Well, I'll say a couple of things. One is that at this moment, the challenge is that we as commissioners are not able to talk about individual districts per se, because we are approaching a point in time in which we will be in the litigation phase of the maps. And so, you know, as you might understand, we have certain parameters around what we can talk about. I certainly can talk more about the process, and particularly at the congressional level. You know, as one commissioner, I will say that drawing congressional maps for Northern California was very challenging for a number of reasons. One is that particularly in the South Bay, you're bumping up against Monterey County, which is covered by Section 5 of the Federal Voting Rights Act, has an impact, is essentially an immovable part of the region that particularly has impacts as you look into the South Bay part of the region. In addition, you have Northern California's unique geography, some of which, for example, the bridges we heard from the communities are really permeable and serve as connectors for the communities that surround them, and other bridges, such as, say, the Golden Gate Bridge or the Bay Bridge, which we were told, hands off, do not connect the communities that are on opposite sides of these bridges. And so by the time you put together a number of different actual physical barriers and constraints in the Bay Area, we had a number of different communities of interest across the Bay that we were trying to unite. And there's examples in some layers of the maps where we were able to do it, and there's examples in other layers of the maps where we were not. But what we tried to do in all of these areas was to apply the same neutral criteria. And so communities of interest was certainly one of those criteria. And in that includes race, but it also includes a number of other factors. It includes environmental factors. It includes economic factors. It can include agricultural interests, urban issues, et cetera, as the community self-defines it. So it really depended on a local place. Even within the same city, you would have 10 community members come to a given meeting, and sometimes the testimony would correlate, and sometimes you would have 10 different visions of what a place defined itself as.
So this last set of maps, and I'm sorry, I have not been listening to the entire show, actually. I have to admit, I'm at a Giants game right now. Go Giants. I stepped out to talk to you guys. But is this last set of maps essentially the final set? There will be no tweaking at this point left on those maps?
At this point, the draft final maps have been released for public comment. So we as a commission are subject to a 14-day noticing and public comment period. And so at the end of that 14-day period, we will come back. We're continuing to review all of the public comment, and that public comment will inform our final decisions as we take separate votes on each of the Assembly, the Senate, the Congressional, and the Board of Equalization districts on the 15th of August.
Okay. We're almost at the top of our show, but thank you so much for calling in, Mayor.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate the work you guys are doing. Bye.
So I want to just talk about the possible litigation. You know, that's clearly something that you all see as a possible next step, correct, after the... And is that something that you're concerned about, or you just see as... part of the process?
Well, no matter what process was used to redistrict, litigation following redistricting is very commonplace when we look across the country. And so it's certainly no exception that we would anticipate some amount of litigation, particularly in a state as large and as diverse as California. the Voters First Act provides that the commission is solely responsible for the defense of the maps. And so we don't feel our work is done when we walk away on August 15th with our maps. It's really the beginning of us being able to defend the maps on behalf of the California voters. And we have hired to help us in that effort two litigation firms. Again, we're trying to get the lay of the land, determine how many lawsuits we're looking at, what is the substance and the likely challenge that those lawsuits would provide. And we as a commission are involved in the long haul to make sure that we win these cases, because we know that even in the short term, if you think about it on basis of elections, it's much more expensive to the California people if we lose these cases and if we're not able to uphold the maps.
Okay, and do you think that remarks like like the mayor of East Palo Alto, Carlos Romero, would that kind of new information, change decisions that you think you've made, or do you feel like you kind of knew what he was going to you knew that going in?
There's very little new information at this point in the game. I think, we as a commission followed the state constitution. We followed the federal constitution, and we are very confident that even though there's no perfect map, that our maps will prevail against any and all legal challenges based on the fact we followed the legal process as we were charged with it, and that our final product, the maps, are really a testament to that.
Okay. We're almost at the top of the hour, so I just want to give each of you a chance to just say one more comment and keep it very short because we just have a couple more minutes. Why don't we start with you, Carla de la Cruz?
Sure. I just want to say that, regardless of what the end result of the redistricting process will be, whether or not it ends up going to the California Supreme Court or the federal court, or even if these maps actually get overturned by a referendum, because Proposition also allows that if enough signatures are collected, the people of California themselves could overturn these maps. So that's an option right there. But I just want to say that regardless of whatever that outcome is, California and its citizens will have to live with these maps for the next 10 years. So it really is important that not only the public engage in this process, but really once the maps become finalized, the challenge will be for each community to really figure out how does this district adequately represent my community or how does it not? Because then the next opportunity will be in 2021 when the next redistricting cycle happens.
Okay. Thank you, Carlo. And Paul, quickly, do you have a one or two sentence comment?
Yeah, I just think that we've witnessed something that's amazing and historic and is probably going to have ramifications nationally and within our state. And the commissioners really deserve our thanks for their contribution.
Okay. Thank you. And Connie?
Well, when voters approved and created a Citizens Redistricting Commission, their hope was really that an independent panel of citizens could engage in a fair, transparent process drawing the political districts for the state and end the partisan gerrymandering that had preceded this year. And we're here. We did it. Our maps may not be perfect. You as one citizen may not have gotten everything you wanted, but there's certainly the opportunity to continue engaging in your community as these districts are implemented and to be more involved next time around, apply to be on the commission, turn out at the redistricting hearings. This is one of many steps in the process.
All right. Well, that's City Visions for this evening. Thank you very much. Our guests were Commissioner Connie Galambos Malloy, Paul Mitchell, and Carlos de la Cruz. Thank you so much to all of you. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, check out our website at cityvisionsradio.com. Our engineer this evening was Bob Summer. Thank you, Bob. Tonight's show was produced by Lisa Denenmark. Thank you so much, Lisa. City Vision's founder is Rose Levinson. Judith Sanson is the senior producer, and our other contributing producers are Susie Britton and Yumi Wilson. Join City Visions next week as we explore the defunding of California's adult day health centers. This is Lauren Meltzer. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.